Well, my wife, well, before she was my wife, since she was a little kid, she's been coming up here with her family. They were from different parts of the East Coast, but as far down to south as Savannah, Georgia, free interstate highways. So her family's been coming up to this area called Squam Lake in New Hampshire since 100 years ago. But we've come as a couple since we got married in 86, and we'd already been up here as a couple before that. So I've been coming up here for most of my adult life, all my adult life. And our kids have, never missed a summer up here. It's definitely a wonderful part of the world. And we're up here a lot of times over around Thanksgiving, and I try to get here during the winter too, because I think summers are crowded and summers are beautiful and wonderful, but I really like the winter as well. The leaves off the trees, and don't see any people around, and it's a wonderful part of the country any time of the year.
Absolutely. Well, let's get some of your story. You're a son of the South, born in West Virginia, spent a few years in Taiwan, and then after your father was killed, you made your way to Georgia and have been there ever since.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, with a very important 4 years I spent away in college at Davidson, which is a college in North Carolina. Most recently known as the place where Steph Curry played basketball for his college career.
Well,
But
a good friend of mine, one of my oldest broadcast friends, left Maine back in the early 80s to become the play-by-play voice of Davidson basketball. And
And who's
then
that?
Steve Martin, who went on to be the voice of the Charlotte Hornets for about
Oh,
30 years.
right. That makes sense. Yeah. Well, Davidson plays in the A-10, so we get up as close as UMass and Rhode Island, I guess, is in our conference. So we get into New England a little bit. But yeah, it's a great school regardless of the basketball program. I was a history major there and kind of had an eye on going to law school while I was there, and ended up back in Georgia for law school.
And now, is it true that you chose Georgia because you thought maybe it might be a little easier than Vanderbilt?
Yeah, that's true. I have to cop to that. If that's been said, I can't deny it. Well, it was a combination of factors. This is the way life goes sometimes when you're 20. I was barely 21, I guess, when I graduated from college. Maybe anyway, whatever I was, it was yeah, I was 22. My big decision, I paid the deposit both places. I could either go to the state school in Georgia, which would cost a whole lot less, or I could go to the private school in Nashville, which was higher rated. They're both good schools. But I decided to go to Georgia for a combination of reasons. One, I was looking for housing at Vanderbilt and I couldn't find anything. It was a rainy day. Two, Georgia started 3 weeks later, and so I got 3 more weeks of summer. And three, I figured I wouldn't have to work as hard and I could do just as well. So I'm not, bragging. I'm not happy that those were my decision points. As it turned out, it was a good decision. I'm glad I went to Georgia. I've been back to Vanderbilt many times. I've actually talked at their law school as a speaker and been on panels and stuff. I have a lot of fondness for that part of the country, and it was a really hard decision. But those weird little factors are what made this 22-year-old make the decision to go to Georgia and not have to work as hard. And I
Well,
worked plenty hard. It
yeah, you
wasn't
sure
a
did.
cakewalk. Yeah.
Well, there in Athens, you started your association with the guys in REM, but actually before there was a band, you bought records from Peter Buck at Wuxtry, and then you worked on the concert committee with Bill Berry.
That's all true. I didn't meet the other two guys, Mike and Michael, till once the band had started. But I just knew them as friends around town. I was a little older than them, and in law school, they were in college, and I got to know them, through town and through interest in music. Like you said, the record store with Peter, the concert committee with Bill. And then once they started the band, the word got out pretty quickly. They're really good. They were a good band in terms of playing. They were also, what always impressed me is they were a good band in terms of songwriting. Their songs, they played some covers in those days because you kind of had to if you're going to play an hour-long show. You're not going to necessarily have that many brand new songs that you've just written. But they kept writing batches of really good songs, and not just one or two, but handfuls of new songs. And then the following week, another handful of good songs. So they were very early on. Somebody once put in an article somewhere, they kind of emerged fully formed. They were a band that did not have a lot of growing pains. They seemed to know what they were doing. They had this endless well of creativity. Every time they got together, a bunch of new songs came out. And it was an exciting time to be there, watching them as a fan.
Now, you weren't at Kathleen O'Brien's birthday party, but you were there at 1111 Coffee Club for what I guess is the first public performance of the band.
Well,
right?
First time, yeah, I was there for the first time they played as R.E.M. I didn't generally go out at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, although they played really late that night and I was there for that. But no, I didn't go to that birthday party, but I certainly heard about it by the following week. I mean, it was a different age in terms of communication and nobody had cell phones. Nobody had all the things we take it, you know, take for granted now. But I heard real quickly what a great show it was, how much fun it was, how many good songs they had. So I was immediately curious and went with a bunch of my law school friends very late on the night of the 19th, 2 weeks later. And it was the first time they ever played as R.E.M. because the first party they played, they didn't have a name. They were just the four guys, some of whom lived at the church where they played. And they just played completely impromptu, or I guess it was planned, but they played casually. Whereas the second time they wanted to put up posters around town that they're playing. Well, you got to have a name for a poster. And so that's when they did the legendary, you know, picked the name out of a dictionary. But when they kind of forced themselves to come up with a name that they could live with and that they would like. And so, yeah, I was at the first show that they played as R.E.M.
We're talking with Burtis Downs. You had gone to law school. You knew the business, but you hadn't studied. I don't even know that you could study entertainment law in those days. But you knew enough to be able to offer some advice to the guys.
Well, let's see. How do I put this? I didn't know that much. I mean, I'd certainly been to law school, and I knew basic things about contracts and you know, other things you learn first year law school, a lot of which isn't particularly relevant, but civil procedure and criminal law. And you eventually learn all aspects of law. And by the time I met the R.E.M. guys, I was sort of second, third year of law school, started really helping them out with legal advice after I got out. But there was a way to take entertainment law at the time. It didn't exist until I started teaching it years later. In the late 80s, I started teaching it at Georgia. But you could go to seminars. There were continuing legal education seminars that go on, you know, back in the 80s when this was, and they go on right now and on into the future, where lawyers go to learn certain aspects, specific aspects of legal issues in the law and business of entertainment. And I went to one in Atlanta. From that, I went up to one in New York. And there you meet people, you end up developing relationships with mentors, and you learn a lot of the substance of what entertainment law is. So that's the kind of the way I went to law school in entertainment law. It was an enhancement on my just general law career. And I certainly didn't hold myself out as any kind of an expert, but I certainly also worked hard to help those guys out and help them do what they wanted to do as a band.
Was it your idea for the band to, first of all, start a publishing company and then incorporate?
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't know if it was my idea. They certainly needed to come up with any kind of form, some form of a business organization, you know, some kind of in different circumstances, different tax laws, different ages and times. But whether it's a partnership, a limited liability company, incorporation, there needs to be some formal recognition of the way an entity is going to operate. That was something pretty obvious, and I'm certainly not the only one who thinks that. And then in terms of their own publishing, that was something that I don't remember whose idea it was, but I think they agreed pretty early on that it was important that they have their own publishing, that their publishing be controlled by them, not, you know, a lot of bands get offered some money up front to then sign over their publishing to a different set of people, to a publishing company. That means you don't make as much money on the back end. It's a bit of a bet against yourself. Yeah, we'll take the money now.
Right.
Whereas if you hang on to it and you do well, you end up making more money over time. And so that was something that they just kind of agreed to very early on, that they were not going to relinquish their publishing. And they never did, and to this day, still haven't.
How important do you think it was to their long-term success to make that arrangement and decision early on that they would share equally songwriting credits?
Yeah, that was something they decided real early as well. They just decided this is the way they're going to do it based on kind of the history of bands, the way bands work out, the economics of it. I do think it was important. And the important thing about hanging on to their publishing and not transferring the copyright was the ability to say no. That's a real important thing in copyright, is you control how it's going to be used. They generally do say yes when movies and television shows are interested in using their music there's typically a negotiation, but we're all for it. We think it's great. We've said no to advertisements. The band's never been up for using their songs in commercials. So they've said no plenty of times to that, so much so that people don't even ask anymore. They know REM is not on the list of people you can, get a jingle for your product. It's just not something they've been interested in having their songs work for. But by being in control of their publishing, that is an ability they have, which is to say no, which is important to them.
Along with changing music, I feel like they changed college radio, and their relationship with college radio was so unique.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of went in, it went a little bit hand in hand with the way they kept going in those early years was the various income streams you would have, and in those days it was way different than it is now. But touring was the most reliable thing you could do. It cost some money. You had to have a van. You had to be able to afford gas, and I guess occasionally change the tires and keep the van operating. But that's basically what you needed, that and time and being willing to get out on the road and play. And they liked playing. It's what they formed a band to do, was to play. And in the towns they went to, a lot of them were college towns. A lot of them had great independent record stores, and a lot of them had great independent college student-run radio stations. That was kind of the blueprint, and it wasn't true just in the South. It certainly started in the South. They started in Georgia. They pretty quickly got to Nashville and to Chapel Hill and other parts of North Carolina and some neighboring states and up the East Coast, eventually to New York, but not right away. It took them a year and a half to get up to New York. But that was it was in the Midwest too. I mean, those early days, when they went to the Midwest, somewhere they weren't all that well known, and they certainly weren't on major commercial radio. They're on college radio. They were in Lawrence, Kansas, and in Columbia, Missouri, and in the college towns in Iowa. So in obviously Minneapolis, it's a big city, but it's also a college town. And almost always college radio was a big part of that, certainly in DC, when they played the 930 Club countless times. And this is when the 930 Club was tiny. And then they moved up from that and started playing bigger places. But college radio stayed along for the ride for a long, long time. And I remember actually one of the most significant awards they got was a big, it wasn't that significant in the scheme of things, but to them it was, which is that when Losing My Religion became a huge song, 10 years into their career, really more, Losing My Religion became a big song in the year 1991, and they'd started in 1980. College radio gave them an award for how much it got played on college radio. And college radio was known, and for good reason, for wanting to break new acts, new artists with new sounds and different sounding stuff. So when Losing My Religion was a pretty big pop hit, it had become a big hit on all kinds of radio stations everywhere. College radio still was playing it. They were still playing it, A, because it was REM, and B, because it was a good song. And I can't remember exactly what the award was, but it was maybe for some number of plays or something that involved how, what's the right word, loyal college radio had been to REM, even after they had transcended that place beyond college radio, which that felt like a special award.